All of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
And brothers, Pennsylvanians, welcome to the Rick Smith Show here on this President's Day. Rick Smith is taking a well-deserved break, so I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg, here from the Keystone Research Center. I'm here with co-host Erwin Aronson, the loquacious Erwin Aronson.
Oh, my questions aren't low.
That's a more generous term than some we've thought of. But
well, I've thought about you, you know. Never say a word when a paragraph will do Steve Hertzenberg.
That is definitely a case of the kettle calling the pot black. But anyway, we're talking inside baseball here. We apologize for that. We're going to try to talk about the issues of the day with all of you. So I'm going to start by giving you a few websites and a phone number. The call-in number, if you want to join the conversation with Erwin and me today, is 1-888-520-RICK. So call in and talk about the Pennsylvania economy, about our nation's politics, about the Commonwealth Foundation's sighting of Bigfoot in Pennsylvania, one of our stories later in the show. Some websites. The website of the Rick Smith Show is www.ricksmithshow.com. The website of my organization, I'm the director of and an economist at the Keystone Research Center, which is the think tank of working people, just like the Rick Smith Show is the talk radio show of working people. Our website is www.keystoneresearch.org, and you can go on there and find out all the latest news about the Pennsylvania economy, and in a lot of cases you can find information about the Scranton area in particular, different parts of the state wherever you happen to live. And I'm also going to give you one more website. It's the blog of the Keystone Research Center and its sister organization, the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. That blog is www.thirdandstate.org.
And you forgot one.
I did.
The most important one.
Okay. Tell me which one I forgot.
The website of the law firm where working people and their unions can come for quality representation. The law firm of Willig, Williams, and Davidson. Our website is www.wwdlaw.com.
Thank you, Erwin. So, we've got three guests later in our show. But before we get to our guests, we're going to talk about some of the things that have been in the news. There's two great waves sweeping across America that have caught my attention in the last couple of days. One of them is, of course, Linsanity. Jeremy Lin, the New York Knicks guard. The Knicks happened to be my basketball team because I grew up 70 miles from New York City in Connecticut, so they were the only team that I could get on the radio when I was growing up. Did you see the game yesterday, Erwin?
Did I see the game yesterday? Of course I saw the game yesterday. Did I see Jeremy Lin engage in Linsanity? Of course I did.
Good. It was First time I had a chance to watch it myself on TV. And
pretty amazing, actually.
It really was. I'm not flawless with the 7 turnovers. But a gutsy kid and an impressive result against the NBA champion Dallas Mavericks. But Lynn Sanity also has me thinking about the second wave going across America, which I'm going to call Insanatorium.
Insanatorium. Well, an immediate past president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, a guy known to many of our listeners and certainly to you, Steve, and with whom I had had the pleasure of working rather closely for many years. Bill George used to refer to the then senator and subsequently former handily beaten senator from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Rick Santorum, as Rick Sanitarium, and with good reason, apparently, based upon what we've heard from his utterances in the last several days.
Well, I tell you, this Republican race for president really is, in my memory, the most entertaining primary season. You know,
well, I don't even know if it's a race for the presidency as much as it's a race for insanity. How much more ridiculous can we get? It wasn't bad enough when we had Rick Perry taking us to the 1950s, or Michelle Bachmann taking us, I don't know where she was taking us, to I think Disney World and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But now we have a contest between former Senator Sanitarium and Mittens Romney, and it's a contest to see who can outrage who. And with the exclamation point, of course, from Santorum, where in one sentence he both bashes the organizations that represent workers and claims to be a workers' representative and advocate. It's breathtaking.
I mean, it really is. In just the last few days, Rick Santorum, again, former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, now presidential candidate, has said a series of things that really defy belief. And obviously part of what's happening now is because he's suddenly either the a close second or first in the Republican presidential race. And so now the things that he's saying are getting close scrutiny, and so and he knows that, which actually makes it a little bit stunning that he said some of these things. So I'm going to start with, here he is at the Detroit Economic Club, and the Fox News headline after he gave a talk last Thursday was Santorum praises economic inequality.
Well. Every issue has to have an advocate, and Rick apparently has set himself up.
I like chocolate.
You know,
he likes economic inequality.
The problem is that this isn't a joke. No. This is a campaign for the presidency of the United States of America, and apparently the Republican campaign has now winnowed down to two. And as I was teasing about a few moments ago, Romney comes out and says that Rick Santorum is a tool of the labor bosses. Santorum comes out and says income inequality in America is desirable and a good thing. And I've had occasion to work along certain lines and in certain paths where Santorum was involved. And if he's a friend of working men and women or an advocate of the people who I am privileged to represent every day, I can't even imagine what. I don't have words to describe.
You're the tooth fairy. No.
Okay. It may be that I'm the tooth fairy, but once we get past all the jokes, one of these guys in the fall is going to be the nominee of the Republican Party of the United States of America for the most powerful position on the planet. And we need to catch our breath once we're done having all the smiles and recognize the outrage, the shock, as you've said, of the words that are coming out of these guys' mouths.
So let's let our audience judge for itself, because I'm going to parse this income inequality quote a little bit. I'm actually going to try to find some sense in it. But here's the quote. That is, I'm going to try to find its, quote, internal logic. But I'm not about equality of result. This is Santorum.
This is Santorum speaking.
Santorum speaking at the Detroit Economic Club last Thursday. I'm not about equality of result when it comes to income inequality. There is income inequality in America. There always has been, and hopefully, and I do say that, there always will be. Now,
and I do say that means he didn't want to have anybody confused by thinking that he was going to be misquoted.
Right. Now, when you read the whole quote, part of the only logical interpretation of what he's trying to say is that he labors under the impression that income...
Now, he operates under the impression he doesn't labor. I promise you.
So he's probably trying to say something about, in his mind, inequality of result is something contributes in some positive way to people working hard and in that way contributes to economic growth. That's the only way to make any sense of what he says here.
Well, I'm
being very generous in saying that.
I'm just trained as a small-town lawyer. You're trained as an economist. Right. Maybe you can parse this. What I get
is... Of course, he's still wrong. But we'll go back to that in a second.
Either way, right or wrong, this is a guy who is advocating income inequality as a method by which our economy can grow and be sustained.
Right.
That inevitably means, if we parse it as you do, that... In Rick Santorum land, in order for somebody to get ahead, they have to be able to step on someone else. That's another way to describe inequality. And, of course, Rick Santorum has a history. When he was a U.S. senator from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, ostensibly representing us in Washington, he was living, of course, in Virginia. And while living in Virginia, his children were... participating in a so-called cyber charter school paid for lock, stock, and barrel by the taxpayers of Penn Hills, Pennsylvania, because he allegedly had a residence there. Now, what his residence in Penn Hills, Pennsylvania that gave him the touchstone was a room in a house that his parents apparently owned. So we understand what he means by inequality. He gets his, and you get to pay for it. And that's the deal, and that's the Rick Santorum that we all know from his history here in Pennsylvania. Now he's on a national stage spewing the poison, and when he gets called on things where he, presumably by mistake, voted in favor of workers' rights as a U.S. senator from Pennsylvania, he now responds to that by saying, well, that was because I was trying to represent my constituency in Pennsylvania, where at that time there was a heavy... presence of unions. Now I'm on a national stage, and you can't judge me by my prior actions. Judge me by my coming actions, whatever they may be. So his coming actions are what? To advocate income inequality for all? That's the dream of America? That's Horace Mann?
Well, so on the economics of this, and we'll take a break in a couple minutes, but the economics of this are that there's now a great deal of evidence that actually income inequality doesn't fuel economic growth, that if you get to very high levels of income inequality, that actually you get less growth. And the U.S. has already got the levels of inequality that it's gone too far, and instead of providing some difference in result that provides motivation. What we're at is a point where
remember we have historical precedents for this,
right,
Steve? There was some income inequality a few thousand years ago in Egypt, and there was some income inequality 150 years ago, 160 years ago in many parts of the United States of America. We called it slavery.
Right.
It was statutory income inequality, and I really worry in a very serious sense when someone in 2012 seeking the presidency of the United States can come to the Detroit Economic Club and announce that income inequality is good. And of all places in Detroit, where a community an estate are flat on their back and just digging out after the horrors of what happened to the automobile industry. He is suggesting that we really need to take another look at these fundamental concepts that are the building blocks of America, like freedom. And that is just downright scary coming from anybody, but someone who is being taken genuinely seriously as a candidate for the presidency of the United States, give me a break.
Right, and again, that celebrating the levels of inequality that we have when it does undermine our economy, and also, again, there's all kinds of evidence now that across the generations, America likes to think of itself as the land of opportunity. Anybody can become anything, but there's a lot of data now that shows that if you're born into a low-income family, you're much more likely to be an adult in a low-income family, and that compared even to Europe, which had feudalism before it had capitalist democracy, we've actually got significantly lower levels of inequality. We'll take a break. You may not believe this, but that quote from Mr. Santorum on income inequality and how great it is one of the more coherent things he said in the last several days. We'll take a look at some of the other things he said. When you come back, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
And community come together. The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Good grief. How can someone so smart be so stupid, so clueless, so wrong? John Roberts is not just any someone. He's Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, the judicial body of last resort with godlike power to impose justice and alter the rules that the rest of us are expected to obey. But what rules of ethical conduct must these 9 justices obey? The answer is none. While there are written codes of conduct for every other judge in America, the Supremes have majestically exempted themselves from any such enforceable ethical burden. This is now causing a public stink for the court, since 3 of the exalted jurists have recently been exposed for participation in nakedly political events to advance the fortunes of right-wing corporate interests for whom they've been ruling. This political partisanship is expressly prohibited by the code of conduct that governs other federal judges, so why should these 9 public officials be exempt? Because, explained Chief Justice Roberts, all 9 of us are, quote, jurists of exceptional integrity and experience. He added that they do consult the code, ducking the obvious difference that he and his 8 privileged colleagues can ignore the code with impunity. At the end of the day, sniffed the imperious Roberts, no compilation of ethical rules can guarantee integrity. Wow, Chief, how sage is that? Since written rules can't guarantee your integrity, why have them for lower courts, for any public office holder, or even for common citizens? This is Jim Hightower saying, Roberts proves that you can't cover stupidity with a law degree and a black robe. A coalition of citizens' organizations is demanding that the court stop toying with the integrity of the judicial system and at least follow the code of conduct for other judges. Is that too much to ask? To join the push, contact www.commoncause.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now the good old union has come in.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, where Pennsylvania working people come to talk. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg from the Keystone Research Center.
Here with your co-guest host, Erwin Aronson from Willig, Williams & Davidson, the law firm for working people and their unions.
Okay. We're talking about, Rick, Santorum and the insanatorium that's sweeping the nation as he climbs in the Republican polls. And we're looking at some of the things that Senator Santorum, former Senator Santorum, has said in the last few days. I'm going to turn now to something he said about public schools. And again, since I'm a think tank guy, I tend to be sometimes too fair to the other side. So I'm going to start by quoting what Senator Santorum said about public schools. In the nation's past, he said, most presidents homeschooled their children in the White House. Parents educated their children because it was their responsibility. Yes, the government can help, but the idea that the federal government should be running schools, frankly, much less that the state government should be running schools, is anachronistic. So we don't need public education anymore?
Well, apparently we don't, but as I indicated in our last segment, the Santorum family does, because they believe that you had a responsibility and everybody in Pennsylvania had a responsibility to pay for educating their children who didn't live in Pennsylvania, but that we don't as a society any longer have a responsibility to educate people at all. And that really is maybe the scariest single thought that I've heard uttered by this guy. And I say that in the context of having heard his commentary, for example, about income inequality. Because in the end, the access to a high-quality, universal public education for our children is the essence of a democracy. When we have people who are educated, who are all entitled to basic educational access and opportunity, regardless of their economic station, then we have the capacity for people to at least pursue the opportunity of which you spoke, Steve, a few minutes ago, but also to be educated, guess what, voters, and to be able to parse the statements made by people like Rick Santorum who want to be the President of the United States. So this is a classic kind of I got mine and you go figure out how to get yours deal. Rick got an education, a public education, by the way, partially in Catholic schools and partially at state-funded universities. His children, of course, got the education paid for by going to a cyber charter school paid for by Pennsylvania taxpayers, particularly those in Penn Hills and Allegheny County. And now he suggests that that very education and that opportunity that comes with it, or the potential, is anachronistic? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's very loony stuff. I mean, the idea, it's already true in this country that your access to education, K through 12 and higher education, we'll come to preschool in a minute, is already very dependent on your income. Because we fund kindergarten through grade 12 at the community level in significant part, it means that these massive differences in the wealth of different communities mean that some schools have Olympic size swimming pools while and nice football stadiums, where other schools have no textbooks and have classes of 30 or 35 kids. But then actually you look at preschool, which is a part of the educational spectrum that government contributes to the least. Mm-hmm. We do have some kindergarten or pre-kindergarten and preschool programs that get federal and state money, but they those programs reach a distinct minority of poor kids, never mind the broader middle class. And so when preschool depends very, very heavily on the resources of the family, what happens is you get differences in access to school and also differences in quality that are even greater than when we get to kindergarten and elementary school. And so the numbers show you that actually a big chunk of the gap between privileged kids and less privileged kids in school comes from before they even get to kindergarten. And so you look at our educational system now, which obviously is suffering very seriously because of economic inequality and gaps in access. And you're going to have the government back away from its current level of investment in the educational system? It's crazy stuff.
Well, it's beyond crazy stuff. It's crazy stuff when it's standing alone and we're looking at Rick Santorum and his utterances. But you have to take this in context, not out of context. Santorum is not alone among the right-wing players who are advocating various sides of this coin. Right here in Pennsylvania, we have a governor who gave us a budget message not all that long ago. It's within the last 2 weeks. And one of the centerpieces of the governor's most recent budget proposal is yet another round of cuts in education, this time a massive cut, and we'll talk about this later, I suspect, in today's show, massive cuts in state support for higher education. Higher education in the form of the state system of higher education and the state universities, where working people's children have access to a higher education, and where we, yes, train our teachers predominantly, that people into whose arm we will entrust our children at the pre-K level and at the K through 12 level to teach them the basics. So we restrict access by restricting support for these fundamental aspects of our society. And that's Tom Corbett. We have Rick Santorum saying no public education is really anything other than anachronistic in this day and age. And we start to see things. We have Governor Daniels from Indiana who's doing his part for education. We have Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin who is slashing and burning teacher salaries. These things cannot be seen as limited purpose facts that just happen to take place in a vacuum from one another. This is part of a, I believe, a broad-based, coordinated effort on the part of a right-wing group in this country, or people who really want to call themselves right-wing, but aren't necessarily right-wing. They are very radical. Okay, and advocating radical changes to systems that have been built not over decades, but over centuries.
But I guess, to me, what's stunning, you know, the fact that there's ideological extremists that want to blow up public education, the fact that there are powerful corporate interests stand to benefit economically from the, what one person recently called the profitization of children, or giving kids the business, to use a different phrase. Those pieces of information aren't really news. I mean, if you and I both know that, a lot of money behind the push for vouchers, a lot of money behind push for charter schools, some of it coming to Governor Corbett and other well-connected elected officials in Pennsylvania. But what to me is stunning is the idea that a presidential candidate could even in the Republican primaries, could try to sell this stuff and think that they can win by saying that the government should back away from its commitment to public education. That is, maybe I misread the politics, but I'm stunned.
Well, it's stunning, but what we have is when we have so many political leaders in so many at so many levels saying this lunacy, all of a sudden, instead of it becoming a fringe or extreme type position, it becomes part of the vernacular, part of the conversation. And by repeating it often enough, it becomes, or it appears to become, less extreme and more moderated, middle of the road, and in the au courant. Right. And that's what's scary. We have these people who are delegitimizing public education for all in the same way that they have attempted to delegitimize any number of fundamental pillars of our society, like the labor movement, like religions that they don't like any number of pieces of what is America today. And that delegitimization takes many forms, and one of the forms happens to be what you express in terms of having this extremist garbage be part of the day-to-day conversation.
Well, okay. I'm not the only one who thinks this stuff is a little off the deep end. I'm going to end this segment and then go to a break with a quote from a Mitt Romney advisor, Eric Fernstrom, just today on NBC. Now, admittedly, they're in the business of criticizing Senator Santorum, but still, here's how they put it. Senator Santorum is spending his time talking about questioning the existence of public schools, questioning prenatal testing. Just yesterday, he was talking about World War II and making a comparison between President Obama and Hitler. So this is again pretty radical stuff, as you said at one point, Irwin. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We'll take a quick break, and then we're going to be talking to labor economist Mark Price of the Keystone Research Center. Stay with us.
Drowning in crafts and lies, save the USA and resume the ties of mine. I'm taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job, join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On February 13th, a dozen protesters were arrested in the lobby of Atlanta's AT&T Midtown Center after they refused to leave until the company promised to not lay off 740 workers in the southeast. One of those arrested was Darlene Jones Owen, who is one of the founders of Everyday People Occupy Atlanta. She spoke on Tuesday at a Valentine's Day rally and said it was her first time being arrested.
I did it for American workers. I have no relationship with the union, but I love America. And I'm willing to stand up for American workers.
AT&T issued a statement saying that nearly all of the employees facing layoffs have received a guaranteed job offer, and the move reflects a shift in business as consumers move away from wire lines. The Teamsters also joined the rally to express solidarity with the Communication Workers of America workers at AT&T. Teamsters Local 728 President Randy Brown spoke.
It's about you and I, us standing together against that 1% that's looking after themselves and doing everything they can to take care of the ones at the very top in the corporations. It's nothing about their greedy ambitions there and what they want to accomplish. More money, more money, more money.
Occupy Atlanta protesters have set up tents in front of the building and have vowed to stay until the company rescinds the layoffs. Meanwhile, the Occupy movement received an endorsement from one former president last week. During an event at Duke University, Jimmy Carter described the Occupy movement as relatively successful because it had forced the media, Congress, and the populace overall to start a long overdue discussion on wealth disparity. Carter said the issue had been ignored by Congress and the media until Occupy Wall Street put the discussion back on the agenda. Michiganders vote in the Republican primary in 1 week, and candidate Mitt Romney has made the dividing issue organized labor. Romney has spent the last week on the stump attacking labor and very specifically the United Auto Workers. He accused his chief rival, former Congressman Rick Santorum, of being unapologetic in defending organized labor, pointing specifically to votes Santorum took against right-to-work legislation. Michigan has the fifth highest rate of union workers in the country, with 17.5% of workers having membership in a labor organization. Romney has been endorsed by Governor Rick Snyder, who has used emergency financial managers to dismantle union contracts in economically struggling municipalities and school districts.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, where Pennsylvania working people come to talk. I'm your guest host, Steve Herzenberg from the Keystone Research Center, here with Erwin Aronson.
Easy for you to say. I'm Erwin Aronson.
It's not that easy for me to say. Struggle with that sometimes. Not perhaps as much as Bill George used to struggle with. The esteemed former president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO.
The Norm Crosby of the Pennsylvania Labor Movement.
Not only called Senator Santorum Sanatorium, but also what he used to call you, Erwin?
I was always Aaron Erwinson, so much so that it took me a year and a half after Bill retired from the presidency of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO to sign my name properly on documents.
Well, our guest this segment was one of the few people that Bill George, the name of which Bill George could pronounce, Mark Price. Thank you, Mark, for having a simple name.
Oh, well, you're welcome. It's always a pleasure to be with the guest host, the Joan and Melissa Rivers of Progressive Radio in Pennsylvania.
Which one am I, Mark? And be careful here.
I don't even know who Melissa Rivers is.
But I'll just let you two fight over who's that.
All I can say is that I'm looking at Steve, and I know he hasn't had a face.
I'm pretty sure I don't want to be Joan Rivers, but I don't know about Melissa. So thanks for connecting us to the popular culture, if that's what you just did, Mark. So I'm going to give Brett, if we had a caller now, can we take callers when we have guests? We can. All right. So don't be shy out there, Scranton. 1-888-520-RICK.
Or anybody listening on the web throughout the world can call on the same number.
Okay. 1-888.
And Steve will answer.
1-888-520-RICK. So yeah, if you call in the next little while, you can talk to Mark Price as well as to me and Aaron or Erwin or whatever his name is. Mark, how have you been spending your holiday? I noticed you were working early today.
I was. I did work early today, but you know, I had a nice casual lunch with a brew and. You know, so it's been relaxing the second half of the day, at least up until my radio appearance.
I see.
Well, we're going to unnerve you, and I don't want to even ask what brand of brew you were drinking.
Now, that's his Turkish wife with the Turkish name, a brew. Although, I suppose it could be a local brand. Anyway. The first thing Mark did very early this morning, for those who don't know, is go onto the blog of the Keystone Research Center, www.thirdandstate.org, and pluck out the key stories on the economy and working families from across mostly Pennsylvania. Occasionally Mark pulls in stories from the national press, and then he does a blog every morning. That's called Morning Must Reads, and actually most of what he and I are going to talk about today comes from his blogging this morning. But anybody who's listening, go to Third and State every day by about sometime by 9 o'clock to be safe.
He keeps economist hours.
He does keep economist hours, so he gets up a lot earlier than lawyers. Good point. So, yeah, no, anybody wants
to. Not if he gets up so much earlier, does he get to work so much later?
Well, if people's work is their hobby, what's their boss to do? Okay, Mark, we're going to.
Where is my shop steward?
Yeah.
I'm right here, Mark.
Not that line again. Last time.
I'm from the union. I'm here to help you.
I remember the last time Erwin and I had Mark on that Erwin was trying to get Mark a raise and Mark was trying to get himself a lower salary, something like that. Anyway.
Advocacy in that fashion is not exactly Mark's strongest suit, but that's not why we're here today.
We're not. So the first story that you featured in your morning blog was by economist Paul Krugman, and he was talking about something called austerity economics. What does he mean by that, Mark?
He's referring to policies when the economy's weak and unemployment's rising. There are a group of people, traditionally we think of them, Herbert Hoover, as the the president of the United States who practiced of what was called austerity economics. You, when the economy's weak and suffering, you pile on and make it worse by doing what you can to raise taxes and cut spending. And that'll, you know, the theory, no one, of course, would do that if they thought the results would be bad. The theory of austerity economics has been since the early days of the economics profession that when you, if the economy's weak, if unemployment's rising, if you cut government spending, if you raise taxes, if you contract the money supply, it'll have the magical effect of generating a burst of private sector activity, and that will help pull you out of the recession faster. And, you know, as I mentioned the name Herbert Hoover, that is usually used derisively these days because actually it turns out that's actually not what you should do. When the economy is weak and in a recession, you do what are typically called expansionary policies, and they can take the form of increased government spending or tax cuts or expansions of the money supply. But the opposite of each of those things was done during the Great Depression, and that's one of the reasons why that depression was much worse. And so Paul Krugman was pointing out this morning that basically, to put the context around it, today European finance ministers are meeting to go over the final details of yet another round of bailouts for Greece. And the news has come out that basically much of Europe is now back into recession. And this is a result of mainly two moves, the raising interest rates, contracting the money supply, sort of making the situation worse, also cuts in government spending. Those two things have helped push the whole region back into recession while they're sort of grappling with these sovereign debt problems. And Krugman's sort of pointing out correctly that this is insane, that we've known for more than 80 years that these are the wrong policies, that you do not make the situation worse, you don't pile on, you don't, you know, take steps that'll actually make unemployment rise even higher when the economy's weak. You actually try to fight higher unemployment, do things that will lower it, and that'll help get you out of the recession. The fact is there's this group of people, sometimes economists, but by and large, policymakers in elite institutions in Europe and some here in the United States that believe basically in a magical theory that well, actually, if you do all these things, all will be better. And we're learning, once again, very painfully, that actually that's not what happens. When you engage in austerity economics, the economy shrinks, as you would expect.
Well, and again, when you think back to the 30s, it's almost as if Hoover had an excuse because you know, at that point, the simple-minded idea that, well, okay, the economy's slowing down, you've got less revenue, so government has less money to spend, therefore it spends less. You know, that was, I think, a lot of the simple-minded view of things, and there wasn't a real understanding of what came to be called Keynesianism after the English economist John Maynard Keynes, who developed, you know, a better understanding of, you know, the fact if government cuts spending at the same time as consumers, households are spending less and businesses are investing less, then you got a triple whammy and the whole economy is trying to drag down, is going to drag down. But again, back in at least the early 30s, when Hoover was president, the understanding of the feedback effects of government cutting spending in a recession was, there wasn't that understanding. But I mean, now it's sort of as you said, Mark, we've had 70 years or 80 years in which these theories have been better understood, which makes what's going on in Europe that much more inexcusable.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, one thing that is common, although I think you're right, you know, in the defense of Hoover, there wasn't a good grounded economic theory to help make the case for Keynesian, what came to be known as Keynesian economics. But there was a well-established ideology at the time, which was that the private sector is always and everywhere better. And that's something that has come back in the last 30 years in the United States, sort of a blind belief that, well, government always does everything wrong or poorly, and anything government does that might be aimed at making the situation better often ends up resulting in making the situation worse. There's a classic quote from a very famous but now long dead economist, Joseph Schumpeter, basically walking through his recommendation for the Great Depression, which was anything you could do, and I'm paraphrasing very badly, anything you could do to, say, boost the money supply, anything you could do to increase spending would just make the situation worse, that what you need is as maximum amount of pain. It's just something the economy has to go through, and eventually, you know, the more competent people will pick things up and will surge back to full employment. Of course, the problem with that argument is that it didn't happen. It takes a long time, and the economic and social costs of high unemployment are actually quite large and severe, ranging from, as we talked about last time I was on, you know, at the end of the day, it takes that a year off the end of the life of someone who is experiencing a mass layoff, right. And the consequences, of course, flow from there, whether it's for the individual themselves or members of their family. And you want to minimize those by sort of fighting unemployment, by doing things that make sure people have food and income, and give the economy time to recover and new sectors to emerge and generate employment.
So we'll take a break in a second, but now let's go from I'm going to give people a couple of actual numbers from Europe so that they can see how badly this policy of austerity economics is misfiring. You've got youth unemployment rates now in Spain that are nearly 50%. Greece, also not far off 50%. Italy, over 30%. That's unemployment rates for people 25 and under. And compare that to the U.S. rate, and we all know how, you know, the U.S. Jobs situation is not what we wish it was, but the U.S. rate's 18%. So you're talking about, again, Spanish and Greek rates are that are more than 2.5 times the U.S. rate. I mean, that's a situation, that's really a recipe for a social dynamite, right? That level of unemployment among young people, Mark.
No, I think that's absolutely right. Particularly for young people, you know, the consequences range from, reduced lifetime earnings, poor performance in school, less ability to go to college, you know, sort of a whole range of, and then the other things that we're very familiar with here in Pennsylvania, you know, the problems of youth violence in cities like Philadelphia. You know, idle youth is a serious problem. So, yeah, I mean, certainly the southern European countries are really struggling. I want to point out, though, that youth unemployment in certain places like Germany is actually lower today than it was before the recession started, and there's a complicated set of reasons for that. Among them, the German economy is very strong, heavily export-dependent. They are a leading manufacturing power. But they also have policies in place that are designed to help alleviate, help spread the effects and the pain of high unemployment across the population. In particular, they have things like job sharing, so that instead of people being laid off, you have reductions in hours of work for the whole workforce. That's then compensated for through the unemployment insurance system, so each individual worker doesn't end up losing a substantial amount of their income when they have their hours reduced. And that policy has had the effect of keeping unemployment for most workers, including youth in Germany, relatively low throughout this period. And it's also a stark contrast, because the German government is actually one of the leading proponents of austerity economics for everybody else. But I think it's important to remember that when it comes to their own population, they actually are engaging in what you would expect them to engage in, which is do things to make sure that unemployment doesn't rise very high.
So we're going to take a break now and then bring Mark back for another 8 or 9 minutes and talk about austerity economics here at home in the U.S. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
7 days and I'll go to work at night.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Earth, sky.
Have you stood outside on a dark night and wondered how many of the countless stars have planets? In early 2012, an international team of astronomers used statistics to answer that question, and their answer is most of them.
They say that our home galaxy, the Milky Way, is swarming with planets. What's more, most of the Milky Way's 100 billion stars have planets, similar to the Earth-like worlds in our own solar system, such as Mercury, Venus, and Mars. Their results were published in the journal Nature.
If they're right, it'd mean that there should be a minimum of 1,500 planets within just 50 light years of Earth. To learn how common planets might be in the Milky Way, these astronomers used gravitational microlensing, a powerful astronomical tool based on a natural phenomenon discovered in space in the past decades. That is, objects in space sometimes create a lens effect, almost like a magnifying glass.
Of the approximately 40 microlensing events closely monitored, 3 showed actual evidence for exoplanets. The astronomers then used statistics to conclude that planets are common in the Milky Way. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Byrd. To learn more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the words 100 billion planets. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you and just share my little point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
That's a great intro. This is Steve Hertzenberg. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, along with Erwin Aronson, Esquire, who was quiet during that last session.
Esquire. Wow.
Two economists talking to each other. Even Erwin was intimidated. Or fell asleep. I'm not sure which.
Or C, all of the above.
All of the above. Mark, are you still awake?
I'm still here.
Anyway. Welcome back, Mark.
So we got like 5 or 6 minutes here to make the connection between Europe and what's going on here at home. Mark, I'm going to start by just telling people, in that Europe situation, the countries with the highest unemployment, Greece and Spain, and to a lesser extent Italy, you're talking about countries that have the same currency as other parts of Europe, the euro, and don't have as much autonomy to control their own economy as we have here in the U.S. And as Mark sort of alluded to in the last segment, you've got German and other European bankers that are calling the shots to some extent within those countries that that have run up significant deficits, partly because stupid economic policies have slowed down the economy, so that's made actually the deficits worse in those countries. So in some ways, those are pure cases of austerity economics, where you've got an imposition of cuts in spending and increases in taxes to some extent from outside those countries. So the good news, Mark, right, is that here at home, austerity economics hasn't been put in place with anything like the force it has in those parts of Europe. Well, even, Mark, even within the last week or so, right, we've had this deal in Washington for 10 more months of extended unemployment benefits and also to extend the payroll tax cuts another 10 months. For those like you and me, Mark, who believe that when the economy is slow, that government should be spending to try to lift the economy out of recession, that was a little bit of good news.
No, absolutely. I mean, the number one item on every sort of major forecaster's list of things to worry about for 2012 was whether the shenanigans, if that's a word I can use with you two on the radio, the shenanigans of the last year in D.C. over the debt ceiling, if those things would reemerge in February here around the payroll tax credit and the unemployment extension, that there was some concern that if those didn't get extended, that would shave a few more points off of the pace of economic growth and mean that unemployment remained somewhat higher. So it was certainly good news that we got, at a minimum, one of the risks taken off the table for things that might slow economic growth.
The problem I have in listening to both of you is that you're confusing economic thought and planning and contemplation with political opportunism that rests in the hands of the people who get to make the decisions about things like extending the payroll tax cut or renewing the unemployment compensation extended emergency benefit programs. And therein lies the problem. And you in our last segment, Mark, you alluded to the notion that Germany is suggesting, of course, that other countries engage in precisely the kind of austerity economics measures that Germany has avoided. And, of course, that's because the Chancellor of Germany has to stand before the German people to get elected, even though they are tied to Spain and Portugal and Italy and Greece and so on, by way of the euro, and because Germany is the success story in Western Europe during a period of time when there are so many less than successful stories, the German political system doesn't want to pay for the recovery of Greece and Spain and Portugal and Italy and to a lesser but significant degree France, which has weathered the storm a bit better. And they don't want to pay for that because there's a political price to pay for that at home. The lessons on this side of the pond, on this side of the Atlantic, are equally clear. I mean, the Hoover example that you cited, Mark, and that Paul Krugman in his column earlier today mentions with some clarity and certainty, isn't the only example. We have more recent examples when so-called Reaganomics were imposed on us, we dealt with that, and we dealt with that very poorly, and it caused a great deal of pain trickling down. We are winding into a break here.
We are.
In
so, Mark,
20 seconds.
Let me jump in. Mark, thank you for staying with us. I'm going to talk about some of the other stuff in your blog this morning later in the show, but we'll give you a pass. So thanks for taking time out of your three-day weekend, and we'll see you tomorrow, Mark.
All right. It was a pleasure, gentlemen.
All right.
Personally, I would give you another day.
Well, thank you, Erwin. I'll be at your doorstep later tonight.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Steve Hertzenberg.
Working man like me, I ain't never been on welfare. That's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. Drank my beer in a tavern, sang a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On February 13th, a dozen protesters were arrested in the lobby of Atlanta's AT&T Midtown Center after they refused to leave until the company promised to not lay off 740 workers in the Southeast. One of those arrested was Darlene Jones Owen,
who is one of the founders of Everyday People Occupy Atlanta. She spoke on Tuesday at a Valentine's Day rally and said it was her first time being arrested.
I did it for American workers. I have no relationship with a union, but I love America. And I'm willing to stand up for American workers.
That's right!
AT&T issued a statement saying that nearly all of the employees facing layoffs have received a guaranteed job offer, and the move reflects a shift in business as consumers move away from wirelines. The Teamsters also joined the rally to express solidarity with the Communication Workers of America workers at AT&T. Teamsters Local 728 President Randy Brown spoke.
It's about you and I, us standing together against that 1% that's looking after themselves and doing everything they can to take care of the ones at the very top, the corporations. It's nothing about their greedy ambitions there and what they want to accomplish. More money, more money, more money.
Occupy Atlanta protesters have set up tents in front of the building and have vowed to stay until the company rescinds the layoffs. Meanwhile, the Occupy movement received an endorsement from one former president last week. During an event at Duke University, Jimmy Carter described the Occupy movement as relatively successful because it had forced the media, Congress, and the populace overall to start a long overdue discussion on wealth disparity. Carter said the issue had been ignored by Congress and the media until Occupy Wall Street put the discussion back on the agenda. Michiganders vote in the Republican primary in 1 week, and candidate Mitt Romney has made the dividing issue organized labor. Romney has spent the last week on the stump attacking labor and very specifically the United Auto Workers. He accused his chief rival, former Congressman Rick Santorum, of being unapologetic in defending organized labor, pointing specifically to votes Santorum took against right-to-work legislation. Michigan has the fifth highest rate of union workers in the country, with 17.5% of workers having membership in a labor organization. Romney has been endorsed by Governor Rick Snyder, who has used emergency financial managers to dismantle union contracts in economically struggling municipalities and school districts.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg from the Keystone Research Center.
And I'm Irwin Aronson from Willig Williams & Davidson.
The law firm of Willig Williams & Davidson.
Absolutely right. Thank you.
Yes. So we were talking with Mark Price about austerity economics in Europe, the failed theory and practice of cutting spending and raising taxes when the private economy is already struggling. And we've learned once again that if the economy is spiraling down, you can make it worse by clamping on the brakes with the government as well. So that all three parts of the economy, the consumers, businesses, and government, are all hitting the brakes at the same time, and you get 50% unemployment rates like they've got in Greece and Spain. And we walked people through that because, you know, it may be a distant lesson, and people in the U.S. may not spend a lot of time thinking about Europe, but it really is, as Mark pointed out, it's the same lesson as we learned so bitterly in the 1930s.
Well, apparently some of us didn't learn it.
Well,
the problem.
We didn't learn it permanently, yeah. And so the point really for us now is to understand the lesson for policy and politics and who we should be voting for given their views on the best way to run the economy. I mean, the good news in a way is that Obama and the economists around him, some of whom I like to criticize. But when they came in 2009, and they did something called, for example, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, they were familiar enough with...
Well, I don't know that they were familiar enough. They were certainly familiar, but if you listen, for example, to Krugman, about whom we were speaking a few minutes ago, Krugman's criticism of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act
wasn't big enough.
Was that it wasn't big enough, that it wasn't targeted well enough. And indeed, earlier today, in listening to some of the reports, I heard a piece quoting Ray LaHood, the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, in which Secretary LaHood said he argued rather passionately at the time the ARRA was being proposed inside the Obama administration that there should have been another $200 billion, that's billion with a B, earmarked for transportation, and he got shot down, and the reason he got shot down was the thought on the part of the political side of the policymakers that it would take too long for transportation investment to get into the economy. But, of course, that would be happening right now, just as places like Pennsylvania are experiencing 6,000 bridges that are under scrutiny because the stress level is so great and the deterioration so far along that they are unsafe. And I don't know how many thousands of miles of highways. And that would be kicking in exactly now, just at the time when we need it most.
Fair enough. So I think there's a lot of evidence that the Secretary and you are both correct, that it, and Krugman was correct in calling for a bigger Recovery Act 3 years ago. But at least I'm telling partly a glass half full story, which is as the unemployment rate month by month was going 7%, 8%, 9%, at one point slightly over 10%, at least we put in place a Recovery Act that stopped that free fall.
But it didn't
get us back to 4%, 5%.
What we have learned and what the lesson for Western Europe should be is that it wasn't that austerity economics works, but that we didn't do enough here to stem this.
Right. We didn't do enough of the opposite of austerity economics. But both these stories, now let's bring them home to Pennsylvania. Because, again, whether it's the European, to some extent, fairly pure case of austerity in Southern Europe, which gets us those 50% unemployment rates among kids or young people under 25.
Which are not dramatically dissimilar to what they were in the United States as recently as 2 years ago.
Well, they weren't 50%.
They weren't 50%.
They were breathtakingly
high.
They were way
too
high.
And for people of color, much higher yet.
No, that's fair. That's fair. So, and then the other lesson comes from here where it's a combination of what we did worked. We didn't do enough. But so that's real world evidence. And yet now what you've got here in Pennsylvania, you know, and Krugman's talked about the fact that the federal government is sort of doing some of the right things. The federal government is doing much less austerity economics than the national governments in Europe. But as he readily points out, what's going on is the state and local governments, which typically can't run unless they're pretty creative, deficits, and they're cutting spending, and therefore they're undermining the kind of recovery that national policy alone would be achieving. And here at home, Pennsylvania is sort of exhibit A, because what we've got now is for the second budget in a row is a really draconian budget in terms of cuts.
Well, it's not just draconian. It needs to be parsed and picked apart a bit so that we see exactly what this is amounting to. Local governments don't have much choice. Local governments, indeed, not only cannot run deficits, but they are also creatures of the state. And because they're creatures of the state, whether it's a city or a township or a borough, a county, a school district, There are limitations as a matter of state law on where their revenue sources can come from and limitations on how much revenue they can actually generate. So they depend upon the state, particularly school districts depend upon the state. And when we have people like Governor Corbett who proposes really not cuts but slashes in important areas such as education, what we're really getting is an economic imposition of public policy thinking from the state onto local governments, coming from people who talk the talk about the real and vital elevation of local government as the key entity, but then they starve the beast, as it were. And it's problematic. It's fundamentally problematic. It's not merely problematic in education where we find things that are so obvious when you have these massive numbers, like a 20% cut in the state role in the state system of higher education, the 14 state-owned universities. But we have it in all manner of human service programs, programs that serve the mentally ill, programs that serve the disabled, programs that serve the underemployed, programs that serve the unemployed, programs that serve us with training and retraining activities, programs that protect the environment, and we get nervous about those because of the very close and cozy relationship politically between those who contributed to the Corbett campaign, be they the masters of charter schools who are making a huge profit out of the changing and denial of education to children, or the Marcellus Shale industry, which was the largest single contributor to the Corbett campaign, who has an interest in how much money the state invests in the regulatory activities, not only of the obvious, the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, the Departments of Environmental Protection, but in less obvious places like the Department of Labor and Industry that has a role to play in the administration of the Pennsylvania Community and Worker Chemical Right to Know Law. So there are real policy implications for the real austerity decisions that are being made.
So we're talking now about policies really at two levels, and we'll take a break in a minute and then talk about this in more detail with another guest. But two levels in the sense that on the one hand, you're talking about really essential services. You're talking about services that make a vital difference to people's lives. But then the other part of it is our discussion about economics, where, again, now we've got a state government that really bought in a way that might have made Herbert Hoover proud, to this idea that all you have to do is cut spending. And so last year they cut basic education a lot. They cut higher education substantially to begin with. They cut a lot of other things, mm-hmm. In varying degrees. But then this year, they've really taken that hatchet again to higher education. You mentioned the 20% cut in the 14 so-called state-owned four-year schools, which really are the education, the affordable education vehicles of a lot of working families, even though before those cuts, our tuition here in Pennsylvania, I believe, was the second highest in the country.
That's quite correct.
And then 30% cuts in the funding for the University of Pittsburgh, Penn State, you know, and Temple.
And Lincoln.
Later in the show, maybe we'll talk about transportation funding, which is a disaster. And it's really hitting the ground in the Pittsburgh area in terms of impacting people's lives. And actually, it looks like the Pittsburgh airport will become the first major metro area airport that is not served by public transit if the current proposed cuts of the Port Authority in Pittsburgh go through. So you've got this double whammy where you've got government operating on this demonstrably wrong economic theory, which Europe is just demonstrating how once again, how flawed the theory is, and the U.S. experience actually, if people could interpret it correctly, has also demonstrated how wrong the theory is. Yet here we are merrily implementing that theory, slowing down the Pennsylvania economy relative to the U.S. economy, as well as having a big impact on people's lives and the lives particularly of the communities where a lot of these cuts go into effect. Doesn't make a lot of sense. We're going to talk more about some of the cuts and the human dimension of those cuts with our next guest, Sharon Ward, after the break. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. Stay with us.
And they're talking in the town square, and they're talking, they're shouting, they're talking everywhere, they're talking never stop. But all their words of wisdom won't make you go away. They need a cold to back you down, and
your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Good grief. How can someone so smart be so stupid, so clueless, so wrong? John Roberts is not just any someone. He's Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, the judicial body of last resort with godlike power to impose justice and alter the rules that the rest of us are expected to obey. But what rules of ethical conduct must these nine justices obey? The answer is none. While there are written codes of conduct for every other judge in America, the Supremes have majestically exempted themselves from any such enforceable ethical burden. This is now causing a public stink for the court, since three of the exalted jurists have recently been exposed for participation in nakedly political events to advance the fortunes of right-wing corporate interests for whom they've been ruling. This political partisanship is expressly prohibited by the code of conduct that governs other federal judges, so why should these nine public officials be exempt? Because, explained Chief Justice Roberts, all nine of us are, quote, jurists of exceptional integrity and experience. He added that they do consult the code, ducking the obvious difference that he and his eight privileged colleagues can ignore the code with impunity. At the end of the day, sniffed the imperious Roberts, no compilation of ethical rules can guarantee integrity. Wow, Chief, how sage is that? Since written rules can't guarantee your integrity, why have them for lower courts, for any public office holder, or even for common citizens? This is Jim Hightower saying, Roberts proves that you can't cover stupidity with a law degree and a black robe. A coalition of citizens' organizations is demanding that the court stop toying with the integrity of the judicial system and at least follow the code of conduct for other judges. Is that too much to ask? To join the push, contact www.commoncause.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
We need to cut the way so we can keep taxes down and make sure we have money for critical programs that help our families and our seniors.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg from the Keystone Research Center.
And I'm Irwin Aronson from the law firm of Willig, Williams & Davidson.
And we're going to talk this segment with Sharon Ward, the dynamic director of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. Sharon, are you there?
I'm there. I'm here.
You are there. Okay.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Irwin.
Hi, Sharon. Good to hear your voice.
Thanks for taking time out of your President's Day to be with us.
No problem.
Sharon, as I just mentioned, folks, directs the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. That's www.pennbpc.org. Sharon, one of the things she likes to do is give things catchy titles. So Adult Basic Sings the Blues was one of the pieces they did about a year ago when the Corbett administration was discontinuing healthcare program for low-income adults that had been funded by the...
You know, Steve, these words, these adjectives that you choose, he wasn't discontinuing it. He was dismantling it. Let's get real here.
How about just completely eliminating healthcare for 40,000 people with 6 months with 6 weeks notice.
But who's counting?
Yeah.
But it was fun. Fair enough. Thank you for getting me back on message, folks. It was funded by the reserves of the Blues, the Blue Cross, Blue Shield operations. So, and then another title she came up with that we like so much, we stole it for another piece we were doing called Giving Away the Store, which we used on a brief about the proposed privatization of Pennsylvania Wine and Spirit Stores. But last week, Sharon, you guys sort of in the title department, I think outdid yourself with a little piece called Commonwealth Foundation Spots Bigfoot in Pennsylvania, which was eye-catching.
Glad to hear you like it.
So explain.
So we'll break it down. I'll walk her through it here. So you were responding, as we sometimes are, to so-called piece of public policy that had been put out by the Commonwealth Foundation, which likes to call itself a free market think tank. So Sharon, walk our audience through. They'd done a piece that was partly about Pennsylvania, quote, welfare spending. What had they claimed?
Well, the Commonwealth Foundation has been making claims for a while now, and they did so in this piece that about 20% of Pennsylvanians are on welfare, and that it is filled with fraud, that most of the people who are on welfare are fraudulently accessing benefits, and that the costs have gone up dramatically. And the fourth thing they say is that we can't afford all of this. And what we pointed out is that the Commonwealth Foundation is, in fact, wrong on all these points, but really they're looking at something and it's not there. Welfare, the Department of Public Welfare is misnamed. It should be called the Department of Health Care because most of the money that goes to the department through the Department of Welfare goes to health care for kids, pregnant women, senior citizens, and people with disabilities. That's it. They also see Bigfoot because they keep claiming that there's dramatic amounts of fraud and misuse in the welfare benefit system. And there's not. We all know that we want our public programs to be run efficiently. We don't want people to get away with theft and fraud. We all agree. But they claim because every once in a while, in one county or another, you'll find some individuals who very thoughtfully and willfully steal, that makes everyone a thief. It's like saying if somebody crashes their car, then everyone needs to have cars taken away because no one can drive. It's simply wrong. So we really wanted to highlight the fact that the Commonwealth Foundation is creating something that, or they're seeing something that actually doesn't exist.
So let me go back over part of what you said. So for example, Medicare. Is that funded through the Department of Public Welfare in Pennsylvania?
No. Okay. Medicaid is.
Medicaid, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
And explain the difference between Medicare and Medicaid for our listeners, please, Sharon, very quickly.
Sure. Medicare is a program that serves everyone once you reach 65 years of age. Medicaid is a health care program that is offered jointly by, paid for by the federal government and also by the states, each state, that provides health care for very targeted groups of individuals, pregnant women, children, people with disabilities, and seniors. And for the seniors, it's in two areas. One is really, really, really poor seniors. It helps who also get Medicare. It helps them to pay for things that Medicare doesn't pay for. And if you've gotten Medicare, you know you have to get a Part B supplemental insurance program, so it helps to pay for that. Basically,
and Part D for drugs also.
Yes, and Part D for drugs. And it also helps seniors with long-term care, either those who are aging in their at home in their communities or those who are in nursing homes. And the truth is that the fastest-growing segment of the Department of Health Care budget is long-term care. It costs roughly around $55,000 a year to help pay for somebody in a nursing home. So that's what we're paying for. We're not paying for fraud. In fact, we're paying to keep our grandparents out of poverty, which I think is a worthwhile goal.
No, no, if we were paying for fraud, then we'd have all these people confused with bankers.
That's right.
No, I know we're still looking at some of these numbers over time, but at least some preliminary numbers I looked at suggested that even back in 1980, we spent six times as much on the healthcare programs that you just talked about compared to cash assistance that goes to people on public
assistance. And what we like to say is there's another 1% in Pennsylvania, and that's actually the number of adults on welfare. 1% of the adults in Pennsylvania are on welfare, and they're, guess what? They're either mothers with children, or they are people who are very disabled, or kids who are living someplace without a with an adult that's not their parent because they're in a foster situation. So, you know, we're talking about a safety net that provides really a tiny bit of support for a very small number of people who are already at the bottom. And I think most people would agree that we've got to make sure that safety net's there. We're talking to people who can't work because they've got disabilities. That's really what we're spending our money on.
Of course it is, and you've made that clear. Mm-hmm. But help us to understand, are the people at the Commonwealth Foundation just dumb, or is there another agenda here? What motivates this?
Well, and sometimes I believe that their thinking comes from the Keebler elves, which I suppose is not can't be proven. But I think
so it's just a fantasy,
absolutely right. There's a strain here. The Commonwealth Foundation is against anything that government does in any way because they want to promote the agenda of either very rich people or corporations who are perfectly happy to pay us less, give us shoddy products that break or kill us, and then take the profits they make from these things and ship them overseas. So that's the Commonwealth Foundation's idea.
Well, if the Commonwealth Foundation doesn't advocate, for example, that we should destroy the interstate highway system that many of their financiers use to move their products from place to place, or eliminate the public airwaves that belong to all of us so that they could just do something there, or any number of things that the government does that really, at a basic level, supports their notions, because after all, this isn't exactly pure capitalism around here. So they're kind of picking and choosing, aren't they? And they're using a lot of code words, not dissimilar from what Newt Gingrich, Newty and the Blowhards, were using a few weeks ago when they spoke of the food stamp president. That's it. Yeah, the code word, the food stamp president. Is there a correlation here between Gingrich referring to Obama as the food stamp president and the Commonwealth Foundation making these bald assertions about welfare fraud here in Pennsylvania? Gingrich, after all, is originally a Pennsylvanian, we know.
Yes, he is. And so is Rick Santorum, that other stellar presidential candidate.
No, he's a Virginian. He just likes to say he's from Pennsylvania.
That's true. He left Pennsylvania a very long time ago. This is really, I think you make a really good point. It really is a concerted effort to do two things. One is to say that government can't do anything right and is bad. And the second thing is to say that to the degree that the public sector and our tax dollars go to provide something to individuals like food stamps or health care or public assistance, that the only people who get it are thieves and frauds. And in doing so, they really undermine the public support and confuse the public about these benefit programs. So I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a concerted effort. I mean, I read today something that Rick Santorum had written about government-run schools, and I'm thinking, I don't really know any government-run schools. I know that my school district has an elected board and that the board makes those decisions and that they hire a superintendent who, like a boss in a private sector firm, hires and fires employees and manages the schools. But they use these words to try to make the case that government is big and omnipresent and therefore it needs to shrink. And that's really their goal, to make it shrink.
Well, you know, they had a guy named Reagan who promised to shrink the government. Then they had a guy named Bush and another guy named Bush, and they promised to shrink the government. In each instance, the government grew. Mm-hmm. And those are the idyllic versions of who people like Santorum want to model themselves after, or at least that's what they say. And we need to listen more closely, it sounds like, from what you're telling us and what I'm learning from you. When we hear the Commonwealth Foundation speak about welfare fraud and mm-hmm. Medicaid fraud, those are code words really for something else, aren't they?
They are. They're there to make people who are working and paying taxes think that they're getting ripped off. And that really isn't the case. What we have mostly is people who are stuck because the banks blew up the banking system and caused a worldwide recession. We have lots of people who have lost their jobs and lost their houses. That's another thing the Commonwealth Foundation says. They say that the increases in our enrollment in food stamps and health care and in welfare are related to just in willingness to spend lots of money. But the reality is that the reason that enrollment in these things has gone up in recent years is solely due to the recession. As the economy recovers, then we'll see enrollment. We'll see that fewer people needing to use these public services.
So at the same time that the demand for these services diminishes, we're putting people back in the workforce who do what? Yeah, they pay taxes. So that's a double bonus for our economy. We're expecting less and contemporaneously bringing in more.
Right.
And to another comment of yours that, you know, this desire to make people who are working and paying taxes feel as if they're getting ripped off. They are getting ripped off. This seems to be more of a political effort toward telling those folks a lie about who's ripping them off. It's not their government and their public employees that are really very dedicated. And in places like Pennsylvania, the number of public employees per 1,000 people that live in the state is actually the lowest in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But they are nonetheless getting ripped off, and they're getting ripped off by the clients of the Commonwealth Foundation who are attempting to pervert the reality of our knowledge and our facts, or are just plain dumb. And I waver back and forth between, are they just dumb, or are they the most cynical misrepresenters and outright liars that we've run into in the course of my adult life?
Erwin, I'm Catholic, so I call them the Nine Commandment people. They conveniently forget about the commandment that says, thou shalt not lie. They're okay with the other ones, but that one there, they've given that one a pass.
Well, I'm reminded, because I happen not to be Catholic, that the word Catholic in modern-day English has the connotation and the descriptor of a religion, but
mm-hmm.
indeed in the English language, the word Catholic means universal.
Mm-hmm.
And I've become convinced that those people are universally dishonest.
I think you're right.
Well, Sharon, one last brief topic, and then we'll let you go. We've done numbers about a year or so ago, and then there's been recent press, so maybe we'll update some of these numbers, which look at some of the safety net programs that that are funded by, for example, the Pennsylvania Department of Welfare, as well as other agencies of the state and federal government. So these are data on all of the different safety net programs, prominent among them things like Medicaid, but also unemployment insurance and food stamps. And I know you know the sort of general finding from these numbers. So I mean, what in terms of where that money goes, do you remember kind of the general finding that comes out of that analysis?
Sure, and it's pretty consistent with other stuff that we've seen throughout the years, other data. A couple of things. One is that the state and federal expenditures for what we call welfare, right? Cash assistance to individuals. It's about half what it was in the early 1990s. So we know that there are fewer people. In fact, we know there are 56% fewer, about half as many people who are getting cash assistance benefits as there were in 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
That doesn't
mean that we have fewer poor people. In fact, the share of people that are actually in poverty is increased, but the number that are getting that kind of cash benefits diminished. And then the second thing that this data shows is that more people are getting more transfer payments, and a lot of that is Social Security and Medicare, and both of those we'll see that in Pennsylvania because our population is aging. If you look at just our the share of our population that's over 65, it's grown, and in fact we're the third oldest state in the nation. So those numbers have gone up, as you might have expected. And the other reason why those numbers have gone up is that people are living much longer. So they're getting their Social Security and Medicare and some Medicaid benefits for, 30 years instead of for 10 or 15 years.
Right. And then if you look at a map of Pennsylvania, I know that like at a county level, for example, if you look at the share of income by county that comes from these kinds of, again, broadly defined safety net programs, what you find is that the region of the state that gets the highest share of its income from these programs is actually the rural areas of the state.
There's an untold story in Pennsylvania about rural poverty.
Right.
You'll find that there are more people who are uninsured. In rural counties, the unemployment rates are higher in rural counties. Incomes are lower in rural counties. The job growth's lower, and there are more people there who are receiving these types of public supports, whether they're food stamps or unemployment insurance in the short term, but over the long term, Medicare and Social Security.
So the lesson for folks in the audience, is part of the sales job here is to get a broad cross-section of people. The sales job that the Commonwealth Foundation and other folks that attack government are trying to win is to actually cut a set of programs that really fairly conservative parts of the state, because there are those concentrations of low-income families depend on that. They're trying to get people to support programs, or support, I should say, cuts in programs that would really be devastating for many of those families and many of those, places. So don't go for the sales job.
Yep, they're bad for individuals, and they're also bad for the economy. We still haven't recovered. We still need to put more money into the economy in order to keep people employed and keep our private sector investing. And the cuts that the governor made last year moved Pennsylvania from within the top 10 in job growth all the way down to below the middle. So we are moving in the wrong direction. We're moving the wrong direction in terms of giving people help when they need it, and we're moving the wrong terms of wrong direction in terms of moving our economy forward.
You're exactly right, and the governor's recent budget proposal unfortunately promises more of the same, movement in the wrong direction.
That's correct.
Well, I don't know that it's more of the same. I think it's an increase of the same, and that's really the worry.
A deepening of the devastation. Sharon, thanks so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks for joining us, Sharon.
Thanks, Erwin. Thanks, Steve.
I'll see you later this week. And, folks, we'll take a break. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Have you stood outside on a dark night and wondered how many of the countless stars have planets? In early 2012, an international team of astronomers used statistics to answer that question, and their answer is most of them.
They say that our home galaxy, the Milky Way, is swarming with planets. What's more, most of the Milky Way's 100 billion stars have planets, similar to the Earth-like worlds in our own solar system, such as Mercury, Venus, and Mars. Their results were published in the journal Nature.
If they're right, it'd mean that there should be a minimum of 1,500 planets within just 50 light years of Earth. To learn how common planets might be in the Milky Way, these astronomers used gravitational microlensing, a powerful astronomical tool based on a natural phenomenon discovered in space in the past decades. That is, objects in space sometimes create a lens effect, almost like a magnifying glass.
Of the approximately 40 microlensing events closely monitored, 3 showed actual evidence for exoplanets. The astronomers then used statistics to conclude that planets are common in the Milky Way. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Byrd. To learn more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words 100 billion planets. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Since the investor class, diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you start to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. It feels, Irwin, like the songs are getting better again. The songs during the Bush 2 era were pretty awesome by the end of his second term.
Yeah, they were, but it takes me back to my days as a university student when the songs were really good.
That is
and
true.
They moved people.
No, fair enough. But, I mean, there's a little flavor in, I guess, that last lead-in and then one of the earlier ones, which I think was a takeoff on the song Don't Know Much About History.
Yeah, well, there was an interview over the weekend, actually, with Bruce Springsteen on this subject.
Okay.
And Springsteen was indicating, in the context of discussing a new album that he has coming out shortly, that this next album of his is a little bit more edgy, and it's a little bit more difficult and attacking of the government and some of our institutions, not the government, but governments, some of the government's leaders, actually, because he feels it's an obligation to have music be the mirror.
Right.
And it was an interesting piece. I commend it to our listeners.
Well, it's funny. There's been a bunch of press stories. A lot of artists are progressive, by no means all. But there are a bunch of artists that have been complaining because they don't want Mitt Romney or they don't want Republican presidential candidates to be using their music.
Mm-hmm.
We could use more of that music that takes us back to the 60s, because a lot of that music is about community in the end, right? It's about what kind of place do we want to be? It's about values, but in a kind of progressive through a progressive lens.
Yes, well, it's more than that. It's really the poetry of a generation.
Right.
The poetry that speaks in the same way that Václav Havel spoke in the Czech Republic during the days immediately before the Velvet Revolution there. This is the passion of a society that is being victimized by a confluence, if you will, of circumstances over which they should have absolute control and they're feeling powerless about. So it's an expression of what's going on, and it's an important expression that we ought not to miss and that we ought to foster, particularly in a so-called free society.
Right. It's going to be interesting to watch. A lot of people have known that the Occupy movement wouldn't be as visible during the winter, partly because of the weather. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, one of the questions is what's going to happen over the next few months with that. There is also a huge issue of what young people do in this election, because they were very, very important to what happened in 2008. And there's been a lot of concern that they're not as engaged, not as hopeful now as they might have been three and 4 years ago. We shall see.
It is the challenge for those who ply the political trade in this country to understand what will motivate voters this round.
Right.
In a way that they weren't motivated 2 years ago, and in a way that they were very motivated 4 years ago.
Right. I want to try to connect a couple dots and then revisit a couple of issues from earlier in the show. One of the things it's important to do is, to go back to this issue of a double whammy. We've been talking a lot about misguided economic theories and cuts in spending. And, again, a lot of what we were walking through in the last couple of segments is cuts in specific programs that, mean that people don't go homeless or mean that people can't afford that long-term care, mean that the unemployed can get extended benefits and they can feed their family. But as you were, again, rightly emphasizing, Irwin, when we were off the air, those kinds of programs are absolutely pivotal to those individuals and those families who receive them. But, again, the earlier part of our show was all about those kinds of programs are also pivotal to everybody because they're part of what keep the overall economy stronger.
Well, the beauty of what became the New Deal in the Roosevelt administration and what became the Great Society in the Johnson administration was a recognition that when we help people who need the help most, that is income or income replacement that they spend, and that primes the economy. People who are unemployed and underemployed, people who are impoverished seniors, people who are living in the rural poverty that Sharon Ward described a few moments ago, are not people who, when they get a little bit of subsistence, put it in their pocket or stick it in a mattress or take a vacation to Hawaii or buy themselves a new Cadillac. They immediately spend every penny of that in the economy. These are the folks that are compelled to make choices between sugar and shoes and medicine and milk. And they spend that money on medicine and on milk and on sugar and on shoes. And that helps the local pharmacy and the local grocery store. It pays the electric bill. It pays the person who owns the house in which they live who otherwise wouldn't collect the rent this month. This is not, as it appears to be so cynically and nastily described by people like the Commonwealth Foundation or by candidates like Newt Gingrich or Rick Santorum or, to a very significant degree, Mitt Romney. These are investments that we make that put businesses on the charts or keep businesses alive, and those businesses then employ people who are and continue to be productive members of our society who pay taxes, unlike people like Mitt Romney who don't pay taxes, or General Electric that not only doesn't pay any income tax at all, but actually gets a subsidy back from the government after making a huge profit. There is something fundamentally wrong with describing assistance programs that keep people afloat as somehow being bad or contrary to our interests. They are in all of our interests, and not merely the interests of the people who happen to be the direct recipients of those benefits.
Exactly right. And I think one bit of slightly heartening news is that there are some of these cuts where you've actually got elements of the business community stepping forward and pointing out that how devastating these cuts are for the business community. And so some of this in the southwestern Pennsylvania, where Pennsylvania's had this transportation funding challenge for quite a number of years now. And
our legislature and our governors, Democrat and Republican alike, have played kick the can with this.
Absolutely. But even Governor Corbett had a transportation commission, which was a way to partly kick the can another year down the road or 6 months down the road. But they came back with a set of recommendations that actually a lot of people could support. Still, they haven't pushed a piece of legislation through on that.
Oh, to the contrary.
Nothing in the budget.
Not so much as a syllable in the budget. And we had Representative Dan Frankel on this show, who's from southwestern Pennsylvania, a few weeks ago. And Representative Frankel pointed to this Republican Corbett appointed task force report as a model. Sad reality is that the governor doesn't even believe in his own processes and procedures. It's kind of like Mitt Romney. Obamacare is terrible, but it was my idea.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that. But in Pittsburgh now, the Allegheny Conference, which is really the major business organization in the Pittsburgh region, really the 10-county area, not just the Pittsburgh metro area. And they've actually been leading the advocacy around transportation funding. The Port Authority, which is the equivalent of SEPTA.
Well, it's the Public Transportation Authority in southwestern Pennsylvania, predominantly in Allegheny County.
Right. And so it's mostly buses out there. They have a small subway system.
There's
right?
a small subway system, but it's primarily buses today. At one time, it was trolley cars in my childhood when I lived there.
Okay. In Squirrel Hill.
Mm-hmm. And East End.
East End. Not far from where I was married. But anyway, so you've now got plans on the books for the Port Authority of Pittsburgh, the major public transit entity in that region, looking
Port Authority of Allegheny County.
Sorry, Port Authority of Allegheny County. Looking at 35% reductions in service that are planned for September without a solution to the state's transportation funding problem. And so that's a projected $64 million deficit that drives those planned cuts. And then part of that is, we mentioned this earlier, is that Pittsburgh would become the first major metro area which has no public transit to the airport. And I think I was reading a press story that said a cab fare, you know, you're talking $50.
$50 from downtown Pittsburgh. More than that from areas that are outlying from downtown but are within the city limits.
Right. So you're talking about a sizable increase in your the cost of your visit to see your, you know, relatives in Chicago or
for my son to get to Harrisburg
to bring it closer to home. Other cuts that are planned is a 35% reduction to a program called Access, which is a transit program for people under 65 with disabilities. So these are, as the press has reported, these are service cuts that threaten to squelch the independence that many people with disabilities have worked hard to attain, and they get to work. You know, they can go to a supermarket and bag groceries or whatever, you know, whatever their job is. Their ability to move around and to have a job and to pay taxes is now jeopardized by these cuts. It just seems so counterproductive.
It's counterproductive. It's counterintuitive in my judgment. And if that were all that was happening, it would be bad enough. But we need to take note of what else is happening. When there's a proposal to cut 5% out of the budget of the Auditor General, the fiscal watchdog of the state that oversees the finances, not merely of state government, but of local government entities as well, we understand that there is a thread that weaves these kinds of things together. First, we're going to victimize the people who are least capable of protecting themselves, and then we're going to have a program for the Department of Education that bundles all the state subsidy issues together, the state financing together, to make it appear as if the numbers workers are increasing when they're actually decreasing. And bundle that further with a predisposition toward charter schools that take taxpayer money and put it in the hands of private operators, privateers. And then we're going to tell the Auditor General that the Auditor General is supposed to be able to superintend these massive changes with less resources.
So just to slow you down for a second, so part of what you're talking about in terms of the education basic parts of the budget, K through 12 school system, is you're talking about there are three line items in last year's budget. One was for basic education funding, one was for Social Security payments, and a third was for transportation funding. And the proposal now is to put those together.
Under the guise of telling the school districts, yeah, this is so we're not telling you what to do.
Giving you flexibility.
You are flexible.
Right. But the reality is that the Social Security funding is driven a lot by the demographics of your workforce. It's not driven by anything the school system controls. The transportation funding is driven a lot by gas prices. And so, I mean, what this really looks like is basically by putting the three things together, you slightly obfuscate the ability of people to say you've cut basic education funding. That's really the point of it.
Well, that's part of the point of it. But the other part of the point of it is one needs to recognize that charter schools, which have been legally permissible in Pennsylvania, for a number of years, have a priority in every school district's budget. So a charter school obligation in any school district in Pennsylvania has a priority over any other expenditure. So if a charter school, like in the Chester Upland School District, has a claim on a school district's funds, the school district must pay that charter school privateer operator 100 cents on the dollar before it allocates 1 cent to the education of the rest of the children. So when they do this block granting that you've just described so well, Steve, what they're really doing is opening the path for the charter operators to steal more of the traditional school district operated schools funding at an immediate time. This would be akin to a bankruptcy proceeding where somebody is going bankrupt, and right before they go bankrupt, they write checks to all their children and then tell their real creditors tough luck. But under the bankruptcy code, under federal bankruptcy law, anything that in the nature of such a transfer in a year before there's a bankruptcy is considered to be fraud and impermissible. It's considered to be what's known as a fraudulent preference. So what we have in the charter school law, coupled with the Corbett budget proposal taken together, is a path whereby we are defunding school district operated schools at the same time that we are saying to poor people, you need to find a way to make do on your own because we're all rugged Americans here.
Just let me clarify here. So the priority that charter schools have to funding used to apply to the basic education funding.
Correct.
And now it applies to the...
Well, presumably, block granted it, so it goes to everything.
It applies to the transportation funding, Social Security funding.
No, because there's no earmark of it.
Yeah, no, makes sense.
I say earmark, that's a bad word. There's no allocation of it.
The fix is in, folks. The 1% are pretty skillful at getting their interests served. So it's up to you out there to not lose faith to be as engaged as ever in this political year and looking forward to fix America's democracy. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We'll be back after a break.
Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On February 13th, a dozen protesters were arrested in the lobby of Atlanta's AT&T Midtown Center after they refused to leave until the company promised to not lay off 740 workers in the southeast. One of those arrested was Darlene Jones Owen, who is one of the founders of Everyday People Occupy Atlanta. She spoke on Tuesday at a Valentine's Day rally and said it was her first time being arrested.
I did it for American workers. I have no relationship with a union, but I love America. And I'm willing to stand up for American workers.
That's right!
AT&T issued a statement saying that nearly all of the employees facing layoffs have received a guaranteed job offer, and the move reflects a shift in business as consumers move away from wire lines. The Teamsters also joined the rally to express solidarity with the Communication Workers of America workers at AT&T. Teamsters Local 728 President Randy Brown spoke.
It's about you and I, us standing together against that 1% that's looking after themselves and doing everything they can to take care of the ones at the very top and the corporations. It's nothing about their greedy ambitions there and what they want to accomplish. More money, more money, more money.
Occupy Atlanta protesters have set up tents in front of the building and have vowed to stay until the company rescinds the layoffs. Meanwhile, the Occupy movement received an endorsement from one former president last week. During an event at Duke University, Jimmy Carter described the Occupy movement as relatively successful because it had forced the media, Congress, and the populace overall to start a long-overdue discussion on wealth disparity. Carter said the issue had been ignored by Congress and the media until Occupy Wall Street put the discussion back on the agenda. Michiganders vote in the Republican primary in 1 week, and candidate Mitt Romney has made the dividing issue organized labor. Romney has spent the last week on the stump attacking labor and very specifically the United Auto Workers. He accused his chief rival, former Congressman Rick Santorum, of being unapologetic in defending organized labor, pointing specifically to votes Santorum took against right-to-work legislation. Michigan has the fifth highest rate of union workers in the country, with 17.5% of workers having membership in a labor organization. Romney has been endorsed by Governor Rick Snyder, who has used emergency financial managers to dismantle union contracts in economically struggling municipalities and school districts.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get paid too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg from the Keystone Research Center. I'm here with
Erwin Aronson from the law firm of Willig Williams and Davidson, representing workers and their unions for decades.
For any of you who want to call in, who are listening on WFTE, it's 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
And anybody listening on the web can call in on the same number.
I'm going to return now back to the Republican presidential race and talk a little bit about the man you referred to as Mittens Romney. And if we have time, we can go back to Rick Santorum. One of the issues that Romney's confronted in the last little while is his position on the so-called bailout of Detroit. when the federal government, this actually began under President Bush, but then was scaled up and done actually very smartly by the Obama administration, which felt like it couldn't allow the three U.S. automakers to go, or I should say two of the three, GM and Chrysler, Ford, did not get assistance, to go belly up, that given the vulnerability of the economy in 2009, that letting those companies go bankrupt would drag down a lot of the auto supply base in the Midwest as well, and was the kind of blow that a vulnerable economy couldn't withstand. And again, the basic reading in retrospect on that federal government action is that it's been a roaring success, that something like a million jobs were saved, and actually now GM just recently announced record profits. And so it's one of those cases where the market didn't fix itself, but decisive and timely government action seems to have helped, and then they've got out of their business. So all in all, it looks like a success story, right, Irwin?
In every possible way, and it is the appropriate intersection of government, labor, and business. Workers took a big haircut to save their jobs. But as we've learned, every job that's directly affected by the auto industry creates six other jobs in our economy. That's pretty startling kind of stuff. And if I looked at the year-end reports from General Motors, for example, properly, they had earned profits of just a hair under $8 billion, with a B, dollars, last year, after being 3 years ago within hours, not months or days, of bankruptcy. What's startling, of course, is that if we allow ourselves that big luxury of looking at events and people and their utterances over time, we learn that Romney in 2008, at the depths of the auto industry's situation, wrote and published, while he was contemplating his next campaign for the presidency, an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which he said, among other things, let Detroit go bankrupt.
That was indeed the title of the op-ed.
Okay. Well, I'm only going by memory.
Let Detroit go bankrupt.
I'm cursed with a memory. And what he said in that article, amazingly enough, was referred to something that he called a managed bankruptcy, which is precisely the kind of thing that actually happened for General Motors, which actually happened for Chrysler, but it wasn't managed by the people who brought us the crisis in the first place. It was managed by people over whom we have a political remedy, our elected officials who were called upon to put our capital up, our money up, to protect these jobs in these industries, and appropriately should have had a voice. In Mitch's world, I guess, we were supposed to put up the money and not have a voice. Or maybe we should have followed his father's model. His father, of course, we know, was not merely the governor of Michigan some years ago, but before being the governor of Michigan, was the chief executive officer of the fourth major American auto company, American Motors. And George Romney, the senior to Mitt, presided over the bankruptcy and dissolution of American Motors, which was composed of such brands as Studebaker, Packard, Hudson, Rambler, and Henry J., the Kaiser, all of which are gone, and all of which were managed bankruptcies by George Romney. Thank you very much.
Well, and again, the title, Let Detroit Go Bankrupt, and the position that Romney took in 2008 was one of those unambiguous positions. Like being the governor that passes health care reform in Massachusetts, otherwise known as Romney Care.
Was its major advocate.
So he can't, even the shapeshifter, Mr. Romney, has not been able to claim he didn't say, let's not do the bailout. And so now he's in this position of the Michigan primary, which is what, next week, right? One of two?
Yeah, Arizona and Michigan are both next
week. 8 days from today, where he's fighting for his political life in the Republican primaries, and now he's having to explain this and getting a lot of bad press Here's a quote from a former vice chairman of GM and a Republican, who, according to the press stories, is already voted by absentee ballot for Rick Santorum because of Romney's position on the bailout of the auto industry. And the quote is, "I think all of us in the auto industry who knew what the situation was were profoundly disappointed and I would say angry. We all saw it for what it was, which was a political ploy to the right."
Well, we saw it for what it was. It wasn't a political ploy to the right. It was political pandering.
Political pandering to it. But now, but it is interesting. I mean, I haven't followed these things closely, but now Romney's beating up on the UAW as and accusing Santorum of being too close to organized labor.
Well, you know, I have a little experience with Santorum and a little experience with the UAW and with auto workers in general. Only in America.
Only in a Republican primary.
You know, and only in a Republican primary and of all states, Michigan. I mean, imagine, if you will, that what we have here is a contest between Santorum and Romney to see who can be more offensive to the largest single block of voters, auto workers, in the state of Michigan. And to be sure, that block has been diminished by the woes of the auto industry, not in the last 3 years, but in the last 35 years. But that having been said, gee, I'm speechless.
Well, it definitely feels at this point like partly desperation on Romney's part, and partly a strategy that maybe it can work in the Republican primary because you've got a lot of pretty right-wing voters.
Really, one of the things on which we must focus, and the most fundamental of flaws in this escapade that the Republican Party is going through nationally, is who votes in primary elections in the Republican Party in the state of Michigan or in the state of Iowa or in the state of Maine or in the state of Florida or in the state of South Carolina. In South Carolina, where the then darling du jour, Newt Gingrich, won the primary, there was a 20% turnout of the Republican voters in South Carolina, and Gingrich got approximately 40% of that vote. So approximately 60% of the 20% of the somewhat less than half of the total voting registered voting age population in the state of South Carolina anointed Newt Gingrich the winner. And we don't know, I mean, I'm sorry that I don't know better whether Michigan's primary is, as I believe, a primary in which registered voters of all parties can vote, that there's crossover voting, as there is in Wisconsin, or if there is no crossover voting. If there is indeed crossover voting, this is clearly an effort at voter suppression, to convince working people like members of the UAW that it's not worth their while to come out and vote, that they don't and can't have an impact as between Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Right.
And one needs to raise the broader base question among all of the Republican candidates and a number of Republican governors, Corbett here in Pennsylvania, Christie in next door New Jersey, Walker. Why is one of the planks of these great advocates of democracy, these great purveyors of freedom, voter suppression? Everywhere. Let's pass a law. Let's do whatever it is we can do to intimidate, scare, coerce, and drive away people from exercising their franchise.
Well, I mean, it definitely seems to me like, again, a line that's not going to work in the general election. But
well, one would think that it doesn't work in the general election. But
With any kind of turnout.
With any kind of turnout, but obviously, the people advising the Republicans are counting on the idea that turnout will not be the same again this year as it was 4 years ago, particularly among specifically identifiable populations, young people of whom we spoke a few minutes ago, seniors who are a block of voters that tend to vote more frequently than the general population, specific groups of working people, and people of color. And that seems to be part of the overall strategy that is very shocking and very troublesome and part of this voter suppression model that is being advocated not only by the presidential candidates like Gingrich and Romney and Santorum, and to a significant degree Paul, and earlier by Bachman and Perry and even Herman Cain, but also advocated by a number of Republican governors who took over state houses in the last couple of years.
Yeah, well, it's, in my naive way, you know, I look at something like the intervention in the auto industry and the million jobs that were saved, and look at the fact that one of the bright spots in the U.S. economy in the last year has been, or 18 months by now, has been a recovery of manufacturing jobs. You've actually got, you've had some currency correction so that the Chinese currency is not as undervalued as it was.
Now, what we have instead is a politically motivated slash and burn charge against the Obama administration that somehow or another, after all of this, the Obama administration failed miserably in the rescue of the largest industry in the United States, and at the same time is unilaterally responsible for an increase in gas prices because of something that's happening sponsored by ExxonMobil and Unocal and Royal Dutch Shell and a number of companies that really are funding subliminally the super PACs that are supporting these very candidates.
Right. The Obama administration itself is actually trying to develop a fuller manufacturing policy, albeit with not many resources, because they can't get anyone else in Washington to agree on spending more resources. But you're right. If there was Republican seriousness around some kind of manufacturing policy, you might have an interesting conversation. Maybe the country can have a manufacturing strategy, which is needed for 30 years at least. But no, that's what you've got is these contentless ideological war. We're going to take a break, and then shortly after that, we'll listen to talk to our final guest. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg, here with Erwin Aronson. Stay with us.
Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Good grief. How can someone so smart be so stupid, so clueless, so wrong? John Roberts is not just any someone. He's Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, the judicial body of last resort with godlike power to impose justice and alter the rules that the rest of us are expected to obey. But what rules of ethical conduct must these nine justices obey? The answer is none. While there are written codes of conduct for every other judge in America, the Supremes have majestically exempted themselves from any such enforceable ethical burden. This is now causing a public stink for the court, since three of the exalted jurors have recently been exposed for participation in nakedly political events to advance the fortunes of right-wing corporate interests for whom they've been ruling. This political partisanship is expressly prohibited by the code of conduct that governs other federal judges, so why should these nine public officials be exempt? Because, explained Chief Justice Roberts, all nine of us are, quote, jurists of exceptional integrity and experience. He added that they do consult the code, ducking the obvious difference that he and his eight privileged colleagues can ignore the code with impunity. At the end of the day, sniffed the imperious Roberts, no compilation of ethical rules can guarantee integrity. Wow, Chief, how sage is that? Since written rules can't guarantee your integrity, why have them for lower courts, for any public office holder, or even for common citizens? This is Jim Hightower saying, Roberts proves that you can't cover stupidity with a law degree and a black robe. A coalition of citizens' organizations is demanding that the court stop toying with the integrity of the judicial system and at least follow the code of conduct for other judges. Is that too much to ask? To join the push, contact www.commoncause.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Well,
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Herzenberg, from the Keystone Research Center, here with
Erwin Aronson of the law firm of Willig Williams and Davidson.
So we're going to speak now with our third guest, David Moberg. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us on this President's Day, David.
Oh, my pleasure.
Welcome, David.
Erwin and I don't know David personally, but we know his work from, at least in my case, reading it off and on for 30 years. David's a senior editor of In These Times and has been on the staff of the magazine since it started in 1976. He's educated as an anthropologist at the University of Chicago, which may well be a better training for studying our economy and our labor movement than being an economist. He's also worked for Newsweek and received fellowships from the John and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Nation Institute. He researches the global economy as well as American unions. So, David, you've been, I'm going to guess that, like me, you've been waiting for the next New Deal for a long time.
Yes. I had hoped it would come without a depression, but if it took a depression, I hoped it was at least going to come out of that. But I think we're falling a little bit short.
Apparently the Great Recession wasn't deep enough.
It wasn't great enough.
Well, that's the hard thing to figure out, because a lot of progressives look to crises as an opportunity. And to some extent, that was what Rahm Emanuel, believe it or not, said when he was chief of staff.
Right.
But crises also generate movements on the right, as we should know from the 30s, as well as movements on the left. And the right has seen its opportunity here as well. So right. We're at a bit of a standoff as to who's going to prevail.
We are. So before I sort of dive into, I mean, when I look at some of your recent stories, again, I see hints of the next labor movement and where it has to come from. But before diving into any of those details, so let's stay with the issue of what do we need to do differently, right? I mean, so again, if we're not getting the progressive change or the scale of progressive change that you and we might have hoped for out of the last 4 or 5 years.
What Steve's trying to ask is, what are we missing?
What do we do differently? Yeah.
Well, I think the basic thing, and this is something that Paul Krugman is hammering away at again in his column this morning in the New York Times, is that there was a lesson that economists of many stripes, not just on the left, thought had been learned from the Great Depression and from recessions after that, that it was possible for government policy to make a difference by increasing demand, by stimulating the economy, by giving businesses some reason to go out and invest, because there were going to be people out there who had money to buy this thing. And instead, we've had this battle, which is, oddly enough, been more won by the right in Europe even than in the United States, the battle with austerity economics, as Krugman talks about it.
Right.
And so the basic framework is that there should have been a bigger move by the government to expand the economy, to take on projects that needed to be done anyway, and accelerate spending on them, to borrow money, to be able to get the economy growing so that we could actually pay back those loans. Second thing is that I think that, although it's hard to prove at this point, I don't think that the measures for control of the finance system were anywhere near strong enough, which, of course, is completely at odds with the presidential contenders from the Republican Party who want to repeal Dodd-Frank as soon as they get into office, and even repeal financial reforms that took place before Obama got into office. think that one of the things that came out of the New Deal as well was a stimulus, both legally and politically, to organizing workers. And that was an important element of the New Deal, an important element of reducing the inequality that had reached the same levels before the Depression as it had reached just before this latest lesser recession, lesser depression, as Krugman calls it. So those are just three elements. I mean, I could go on with things that would extend beyond it, but, you know, the general stimulus, the control over the financial system, which has been still responsible for distorting our economy, and giving more power to workers to have a voice on the job, to raise their wages, to be able to, you know, to make a dent in this increased inequality that people have been fortunately finally talking about.
Right. So let's stay with that third one for a minute. And again, I'm going to make an observation as an economist. We do a lot of work here in Pennsylvania running the numbers on the rise of inequality, including the share of income that goes to the top 1%. And again, we find the same patterns, big surprise, as exist nationally. And when you look at those numbers, you know, it's clear that you know, very little that we're talking about in the state or national policy debate would reverse more than a small fraction of the rise of inequality since the 1970s, right? So that, I mean, even if you could raise the minimum wage in Pennsylvania, for example, to $10 an hour, we're still at the national rate of $7.25. I mean, it would help.
Yeah.
But I mean, so it's, you know, the really the only thing that is a technical matter I can think of that would get us back to 1970s level of inequality, you know, would be a substantial increase in the share of really the private sector economy that belongs to unions. So to pick on your last three stories, you know, if we could organize Walmart and other big box chains, if we could organize the restaurant, or let me broaden it slightly, the food and drink sector, if we could organize hospitality, because those are the three sectors that sort of your last three stories talk about, then you might be, you know, on your way towards creating a new middle class in the, you know, less mobile parts of the service sector. Whereas I can see as an economist that that's what we need, and I can even connect the dots across your stories or across other examples of innovative organizing in the services and imagine those things happening, there isn't really, a national discussion going on about that's not really on the screen, is it?
No, I don't think so, unfortunately. I think that there had been a rise in steady rise for a number of years in interest by workers who were not in unions and joining unions, according to public opinion survey.
Right.
At the start of the recession, there was some dip in how polls showed popularity of unions. I think that was a momentary anomaly as a result of the recession. So there are a lot of workers out there who are interested in joining. Part of it is that a lot of people are just discouraged about whether anything can make a difference. So they're not as likely to put a great deal of effort into organizing, nor are they willing to tolerate the kind of abuse and tension that's brought on by employers frequently, or almost always, when workers do try to organize. And I think that engaged in some kind of organizing activity. I mean, to a large extent, that did happen in the 1930s when there was this surge of organizing. Not only were union activities given the sanction and support of law, in fact, we still have the same national labor policy, that it is the policy of the government to actually encourage collective bargaining and unionization.
No, but filtered by 80 years of insane decisions by the labor board and the courts,
yeah.
Some of which I've unfortunately had my hand in, but I mean, it really, really where you're going with this speaks, at least to me, in terms of not what we need to do again, but what do we need to have change, if anything, in order to create the foundation for the same progress that we made from 1935, certainly through the mid-1960s to the late 1960s.
Progress in the labor movement?
Yes, progress. Yeah. We're really talking about what the appropriate model is for the labor movement going forward.
Yeah. Well, I think what makes a huge difference, made a huge difference in the past, will make a huge difference in other countries, and will make a big difference in the future, is the kind of political support that union organization gets. It is not simply a struggle in the workplace by one group of workers trying to establish collective bargaining. It's a key political struggle over what kind of voice workers are going to have in society. Because one of the things that Republicans seem to know better than Democrats is that if more workers are organized, more workers are likely to be voting for progressive candidates, which is more likely to mean voting for Democrats.
Right. So some Democrats are just oblivious to that. But.
Yeah, they take for granted the money they get given when they're initially running for office.
Well, not just the money. Not just the money, and not even primarily the money, although the money's an issue. Candidly, the labor movement in this country can't effectively compete economically, but certainly not now, but it is true, however, nonetheless, even now, that the labor movement has certainly successfully outpopulated the other side, and there are more of us than there are of them, and they tend to take that for granted as well.
Oh, yeah. And what typically happens is that as a Democrat wins office, oftentimes disproportionately relying on labor work and members being out knocking on doors, is that they will turn increasingly to money from big business. Businesses see that as a way of buying access, whether they're Democrats or Republicans.
Right, right.
And then the Democrats who got elected find themselves in a position where they don't really rely on working people that much anymore, and they don't respond particularly well to pleas by unions to make it easier for workers to organize.
But, I mean, I want to go back a little bit. I'm going to play optimist here.
Okay. I'll join in.
It's forces in it. Well, so here, I mean, I do think, yes, you're right, the Tea Party is one of the things. The right-wing organizing is one of the things that came out of the Great Recession. But it's also true that the Occupy movement, and again, you wrote about the Occupy Harvard movement in one of your recent stories. So that's the Occupy movement, including some of its student chapters, are a still unfolding story that came out. And I think related to that, the discussion about inequality that we're finally having, which you alluded to, David, a little while ago. I mean, finally, at least, the country is having a conversation or asking a question, right? How do we reverse the growth of inequality, which people are finally recognizing, it kills the American dream and also undermines economic growth. and having a strong economy and being the land of opportunity are part of what's special about America, right?
Yeah.
So they're finally, again, asking a question to which the labor movement is the answer. Right. So at least that's, you know, I mean, a revived labor movement, you know, which has 35% density in the private service sector is the answer. So at least the climate, I think, is better now than it's been in a long time for trying to make some of the arguments we need to make.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned the Occupy Harvard, you know, significant in another way in that over the last decade or so, there's been a steady growth in student support for labor unions, oftentimes for
right.
unions of workers on campus, but off campus as well. And that kind of spread of a alliance to a crucial group of people, many of whom are drawn into working for the labor movement as a result of their activities. But it's also, you know, these are key young leaders in many cases who have a kind of sympathy for the labor movement that they will take into other endeavors that they undertake. So
right.
I think that's an optimistic side of things as well.
I'm going to point to a couple other things in your recent stories. Again, let's go back over the Walmart thing. I mean, one way of looking at Walmart is, you know, obviously they're adamantly anti-union. Whatever unionism was left within the retail sector, and now as they've expanded to food, you know, in the supermarket sector, which had a much higher union density. You know, their role so far has been to reduce the number of union jobs. But I guess the one, and they've got enormous economic power. So they can wage their battles, legal and otherwise, against unions with phenomenal resources and all the advantages of a lousy labor law that Irwin alluded to. But I guess to me the flip side is Walmart is exhibit A of a much more concentrated service economy than we had 30 years ago.
Right.
It's like when we got Flint, when we got the GM plant in Flint, Michigan, then within a relatively short amount of time, because you had these huge plants and you had these huge companies, you had an industry. And so I guess in a certain way, and frankly, Walmart can make money whether big box stores are unionized or not. It's not central to their business model that they be non-union. At least I don't think it is. I do feel like increasing concentration in the services in one way opens the door in the right circumstances to a wave of unionization in a way that more so, let's say, than very, very fragmented ownership structures in the services.
Yeah. Despite that concentration that's certainly taken place in ownership in the service and retail sector, there is a contrary phenomenon that doesn't make organizing even more complicated. It would be bad enough under almost any circumstances to confront such a colossus as Walmart that is adamant about fighting unions, that it will shut down doors for workers.
Right.
Canada, for example, have voted to organize.
Right.
But one of the things that's true in most of Walmart's warehousing operation, for example, which is where a lot of attention has been focused recently by workers who are upset with not getting paid overtime, not getting paid even the minimum wage because they're on piecework standards, is that within these warehouses, even though they handle entirely Walmart merchandise, much further for workers, all of which is probably Walmart's attempt to take any kind of responsibility. And if there's any kind of move by those employees of the subcontractors to organize, they simply dismiss the subcontractors.
No, you're right. But again, you presumably heard about the Hershey dispute in Derry Township,
yeah.
10 miles from where I sit, in Harrisburg. And, yeah, so...
No, there are ways of overcoming it. And, you know, in fact, a lot of the organizing of janitors by service employees in the last couple of decades has been in circumstances where they had to find a way around it. So it's not insurmountable. But I think, actually, these right. big warehouses have a more factory-like quality about them in some regards.
They do.
Well, so do the big pharmacy benefit management companies that have factories that are dispensing prescriptions. But,
right.
You know, and terrible conditions for not only the techs, but actually for the pharmacists who are supposed to be in charge as well. And they really are assembly lines, not breathtakingly or significantly dissimilar from the automobile plants or the... electronics plants or the tire plants of another era,
yeah.
and
the fulfillment operations for Amazon and
sure.
other online.
But I think that's true. But again, there are also other situations. Like again, the other sector you've written about recently, David, is the restaurant sector, right?
Yeah.
And so where that's a case where you've actually got growing. I don't even know the right terms. You've got growing concentration in the restaurant sector, too. You tend to have these sort of fairly localized regional conglomerates. So the same small number of people will own, like, a whole bunch of restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way around that. You're still... Well, and people are being made to work very hard in those situations, whether they're in the washing dishes or they're waiting tables. It's different than factory work.
Yeah.
But I guess so. And we don't have time to dig into it. But the story, the innovative, I'm going to call it organizing broadly defined, that's happening in the restaurant sector, that's being done by this group called the Restaurant Opportunity Center, that you wrote about, is, again, to me, it's another positive example. And I feel like part of what we need to do is more powerfully paint a picture of, okay, America, you don't like inequality, you want a middle class, so here concretely is what it looks like, building on the examples of the hotels that were just written about in New York City, that, you know, where people will earn $60,000 a year by the end of their current new contract, or janitors, which are organized, as you know, David, in Philadelphia or in a range of cities where the service employees through Justice for Janitors has had some success at creating area-wide wage and benefit standards of $15 an hour plus sort of half decent, you know, pension and benefits. And so I guess I feel like so far, folks like us and innovative unions haven't really managed to paint a clear enough concrete picture of a possible America where, again, you've got much more widespread unions in different large pockets in the service sector, and that if we can connect the dots better for people and paint that picture, I mean, we need to do that, and it'll help, I guess, is where I'm going.
Yes. I would fully agree. I mean, I think that, you know, there's no question but what the vast majority of jobs now are in and are even more going to be in various low-wage, modern skilled parts of what gets called the service sector.
Right.
And even though I would insist from a point of view of the economy and the workforce in this country, it's still important to try to preserve and advance manufacturing.
Absolutely.
Service sectors that are going to going to be where the numbers are. And
in terms of jobs.
Also where
yep.
there's actually been, with a lot of these big companies, an increase in productivity, and not been increases in wages, which is one of the striking phenomena since the mid-70s, is the flatline of real wages and
right.
continuing increase in productivity with all the gap between there going essentially to that 1%.
Right. No, you're exactly right. So, David, we need to take a break here, so I'm gonna let you go.
Okay,
but thank you very much, and we're going to reflect a little bit on this conversation.
And we're going to ask you to allow us to call on you again and bring you into this show and bring you into our conversation here.
Anytime. I'm happy to contribute whatever I can.
Thank you, David.
Thank you
and
very
keep
much.
Up the good work. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Stay with us.
The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Have you stood outside on a dark night and wondered how many of the countless stars have planets? In early 2012, an international team of astronomers used statistics to answer that question, and their answer is most of them.
They say that our home galaxy, the Milky Way, is swarming with planets. What's more, most of the Milky Way's 100 billion stars have planets, similar to the Earth-like worlds in our own solar system, such as Mercury, Venus, and Mars. Their results were published in the journal Nature.
If they're right, it'd mean that there should be a minimum of 1,500 planets within just 50 light years of Earth. To learn how common planets might be in the Milky Way, these astronomers used gravitational microlensing, a powerful astronomical tool based on a natural phenomenon discovered in space in the past decades. That is, objects in space sometimes create a lens effect, almost like a magnifying glass.
Of the approximately 40 microlensing events closely monitored, 3 showed actual evidence for exoplanets. The astronomers then used statistics to conclude that planets are common in the Milky Way. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Byrd. To learn more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the words 100 billion planets. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to guest host Steve Hertzenberg from the Keystone Research Center.
And Erwin Aronson from the law firm of Willig, Williams & Davidson.
So, this last segment, I'm going to take us back to where we started, which is your favorite former Pennsylvania senator and mine. Oh, I tell a lie. Rick Santorum, in senatorium, the other wave, along with Lynn Sanity.
Well, maybe we need to give him the wave. That sounds like a
give him the wave?
Yeah.
So, no, I'm going to read a couple more Senator Santorum quotes here and ask you.
Rickisms.
Rickisms. and ask you what they mean. So here's one. They are taking faith and crushing it. Why? When you marginalize faith in America, when you remove the pillar of God-given rights, then what's left is the French Revolution. What's left is a government that gives you rights. What's left are no No unalienable rights. What's left is a government that will tell you who you are, what you'll do, and when you'll do it. What's left in France became the guillotine. What the heck does that say?
I give up. I'll go along with your silly little game. What does that say?
I don't know.
I think that that is what you call one of Rick's rantings.
I sort of it seems a game of fairly free association.
Well, you know, maybe this is the political equivalent of Ayn Rand, or maybe James Joyce. I don't know. There is a certain Santorumness to this, however, which is. When, over many years of his serving in the United States Senate and the U.S. House before that, he was faced with something that was quizzical to him. He went off on a rant that was aimed at attempting to demonstrate to the uninitiated listener that he was somehow erudite. And I think that what this is an effort to demonstrate his erudition by saying something that is so unintelligible and so beyond our capacity to understand, much less reason and slot in, that we just say, oh, well, he's above us, and this is beyond us. And to those who he is attempting to get to support his nascent candidacy for the presidency of the United States, we have the big impression. But I don't know. I confess to you that your reading that statement to me was not the first time I had attempted to contemplate it. I heard it over the weekend. I brought it up on the internet. Well, I read it.
I'm thinking of investing in Santorum calendars. Although they have to be a little bigger than the Bush calendars.
Well, you know, everybody, yeah, they would have to be a bit bigger. But we live in a world of the soundbite. And Rick doesn't seem to be in that world of the soundbite. He is in this other bite. And I don't know what he's biting exactly, but I confess that I can't chew it.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably a sincere and intense rant saying what I just quoted is part of how he gets the authenticity label.
Well,
I mean, listen. If you're Romney, even if you're reading cue cards, I don't think you could get yourself to read that.
So well, it would be hard to read that, and that is true. But I mean, understand, deal with this group of people that we're dealing with. Newt Gingrich sells himself as a university professor, a man of words and letters. We all know that. He did teach at a university, and indeed the subject that he taught was supposed to be history, but I have a lot of introductory words to Newt Gingrich. None of them sound a great deal like professor. A lot of them sound like something else. And this is a struggle. Romney has his chops, if you will, by having putatively been a successful businessman.
Successfully chopped lots of jobs.
He successfully chopped lots of jobs.
He wants to be chopper-in-chief.
So he wants to be chopper-in-chief. We know, of course, that when it came to the Olympics that he was the executive of, that was patchwork together by a series of federally sponsored, mandated, taxpayer-financed earmarks, which he, of course, is against. And then he was at Bain or Bain Capital, which was better named Payne Capital. But so he has his chops, if you will, as a business executive, somebody who could play with the big boys. And Newt, of course, ran the government. I saw his commercials, particularly as he ran in Florida and South Carolina, and he obviously was the epicenter of all government during his time in the House of Representatives. There was that parenthetical guy in the White House at the time. I think his name was Clinton. But it was Newt who ran things. And on top of that, he must be a genius because he has a doctorate from somewhere. And he taught at a university. So now we have Santorum. Santorum is trained as a lawyer, but has fundamentally done nothing other than being a Pennsylvania State Senate staff member and then a member of the Congress of the United States, a member of the U.S. Senate, and in more recent years, since he lost by monumental proportions when he ran for re-election to the Senate, a talking head. But he's never produced anything. The only job that he's responsible for creating is his own. And he has an opinion on everything from the French Revolution to how we deliver education in our society, to what people have a right to medical care, to what is fair in terms of the context of income distribution. So maybe these rants are a way of him demonstrating to a less initiated world than we Pennsylvanians are who got to know him exactly how smart he truly is.
If you say so.
Yeah.
I'll give you.
And the cure for unemployment is jobs, yes.
This is one last comment, plus an attempt by Sorum to explain this. Again, within all of this, within the last few days, it's not about you, Santorum declared. He's talking as if he was talking to Obama. It's not about your quality of life. It's not about your jobs. It's about some phony ideal, some phony theology. Oh, not a theology based in the Bible, a different theology. Again, leaves you mystified. I'm reading it and have no idea.
But these are the code words. He rapidly, when attacked about that, said he wasn't speaking of President Obama's religious theology or his commitment to Christianity and Christian values, but he was talking about something else. However, we all know what he was saying, and he knew what he was saying, and it's not a whole lot different than Newt Gingrich talking about Obama being the food stamp president.
Yeah, okay.
These are code words, and those of us who watch the development of politics know this. Listen, this is the same Rick Santorum whose principal campaign fundraiser, being interviewed for reasons that astound me separate and apart from what he said, on the subject of contraception in the context of the American health care law, suggested that the appropriate method of birth control was for a woman to hold a bare aspirin between her knees. And he said this with a totally straight face, and Santorum then subsequently attempted to distance himself from the comment by suggesting that his principal fundraiser, his fundraiser-in-chief, was trying to be humorous. Well, there's precious little humor in that when it comes to women and the rights of women to control their destinies and their bodies. And this arrogant 1951 attitude that is where they're trying to say they're bombing us back to, when we know, in fact, that it's 1851, not 1951.
Well, we don't have any primaries this week, right? There are no Republican primaries
tomorrow. Republican primaries, but there is a Republican debate taking place in Arizona on Wednesday night.
Wednesday night.
And the debate is now among Ron Paul, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and Mittens Romney, and we will see what we will see among the big four. But immediately after the debate, there will be a few absolutely neutral, unbiased talking pundits, Michelle Bachmann.
Is she now a pundit again?
Michelle is back to being a pundit. I saw her on the Sunday talk circuit yesterday. And Rick Perry will be back talking about how we really calculate things. If we're really lucky, Herman Cain, that progenitor of common sense.
I have to admit, partly since I give at the office public policy issues, I haven't watched any of the Republican debates yet from the beginning to the end. I think I may make an exception in this case.
This is well worth watching if we like comedy and Comedy Centralism on your cable TV channel system.
You know, I also have not been watching Saturday Night Live recently, this is self-parody, Republican
it is.
Presidential race. So we'll look for more of that self-parody on Wednesday. And we'll wrap it up for now. Rick Smith will be back tomorrow in this chair. I'm Steve Hertzenberg.
And I'm Erwin Aronson. Thanks for listening.
America better. Email Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color like the tide and flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is colored.